2020 has swept in changes across the globe and in our literary operation as our editor Robert Stewart wraps up his decade's work with New Letters Magazine. We'll celebrate his final issue of New Works with readings by a few of the poets included, some published in the magazine for the first time and others who have honed their craft with the journal over years, such as Trish Reeves, who shares stories and observations along with their poetry.
People talk about an editor's editor. That's Bob Stewart.
Also hear new poetry by two-time winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award, Albert Goldbarth, along with former Kansas Poet Laureate Karen Miriam Goldberg and a graduate of UMKC's MFA Creative Writing Program, John Mester. We'll also hear a letter from poet John Balaban, read by H.C. Palmer, who reviewed Balaban's recent book in this issue. And fiction writer Christy Hodgen talks about taking over Bob Stewart's role as editor. That's ahead on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and here's Robert Stewart reading from his editor's note in Volume 86, 1 and 2.
The essay is called That's It. When the Japanese poet Basho lay dying, friends asked him to compose a death poem. According to scholar R.H. Blythe, Basho replied, quote, "It has been customary to leave behind a death poem, but every moment of life is the last, every poem a death poem. Why then, at this time, should I write one? In these, my last hours, I have no poem." Unquote. Basho's principle, in its unnerving simplicity, its mystery, has come clear to me only now, decades since first reading that story. After more than 40 years of working on New Letters Magazine, as managing editor and then as editor, I realized that our goal with each publication was to create the final issue. Indeed, those editions of the magazine that I considered to be among the best were the hardest to live with. They would leave me terrified to do it over again. I often held a new edition in my hands shortly after it came out and would tell myself, that's it. I would never top it. Then, in a short time, we would start again to gather the new work of writers and artists. This process will continue under my successor, Christy Hodgen, a superb writer herself. What a privilege to work each day in a world in which every moment of life is the last. I did nothing to earn the intensity and power these editions have woken in me. I must be honest. The writing and art were gifts of genius and faith others have provided.
That's the first part of That's It, the editor's note by Robert Stewart in his final issue of New Works for New Letters, a magazine of writing and art. This double volume came out shortly before the 2020 COVID-19 shutdown, when we hosted a release party at the beautiful Diastole Scholars Center in Kansas City. Before the reading, we reviewed some of the artwork from magazine covers throughout Bob's years, from 1973, when he was a young volunteer under editor David Ray, working his way up to managing editor by 1981. He continued in that role when Jim McKinley became editor in 1986, before taking over from him 16 years later. One of Bob Stewart's all-time favorite covers was that of his first full issue as executive editor in 2003.
That's a work of art by Robert Stackhouse, and I have to admit that I had that in my mind for a long time, to feature Stackhouse in the magazine. Selfishly, I didn't tell Jim about it. And because I knew that's what I wanted when I took over, so I saved him up.
Oh, wow, secret. That's kind of cool.
But, yeah, no, he's a big deal. He was here in Kansas City for a while.
Right, so. I remember him being here. So, who's first? John, correct me if I'm wrong, but you are one of our UMKC MFA students. Is this the first poem that Bob has taken for the magazine?
It is.
Yeah.
I wish we had more time.
You can say my record is one for one.
Then. That's right.
Okay. That'll be great. I was writing these poems actually while I was in Bob's class, and his class was incredibly influential for me, mostly just because of the ease of knowledge with which he sort of spoke about writing and poetry and pulled quotes out of the air.
Did Bob help you particularly with this one?
Well, he used a quote a lot in class by Simone Weil, that absolute attention is prayer. And as I was writing a collection of poems for my father-in-law who passed away in 2016. And just kind of looking at objects and looking at different things that encapsulated memory and space and time. I remember him also mentioning The Poetics of Space by Bachelard, and those things were kind of just swirling around as I was trying to work on these poems and trying to work on how I wanted them to come out. And so, yeah, this poem I think is kind of quiet in that sense, that it sort of gives its attention to something and tries to honor it. So this is called Ode on an Urn
by John Messner.
And it's got an epigraph from John Keats. When old age shall this generation waste, thou shalt remain in midst of other woe. Rounded like a bent knee and smooth like the matte feel of a room lit through opaque glass. The geometry of something shaped by hands, its curves always return to itself. A body for a body, or a collection of the body's elements. Fire, sand, bone, earth. Time is still underneath its closed lid, a fixed point, dark cavity, quiet except for the dull echo of the world outside, turning, turning always forward towards some bright, fiery end.
Ode on an Urn by John Messner, one of Robert Stewart's students. And this is New Letters on the Air. Bob, any comments?
I'm just always in awe when students send any of their poems back to New Letters. That's exactly what you want. John is just a tremendously good poet, and so I was thrilled to get this.
Our next poet is Trish Reeves. And Trish has been around. For a long time.
Okay, thank you.
But you two have worked together a lot over the years.
Yeah.
Can you talk about your poetic relationship?
Well, what I'd like to say first is I remember sending some really bad poems to Bob when he was managing editor and I was in my 20s. And I will never forget that he actually took time to say something kind in his rejection, you know? I didn't have an MFA then, you know, no books, but it has never left me because that's how Bob has done his work. That's what I've seen. I remember walking into his office and just seeing him fastidiously working, whether it's a comma that he's concerned about in a piece.
Very concerned with commas.
Yes, I am. An ill-conceived scene, he's on it. He really is the editor's editor. We did do a book together, didn't we?
Yes.
Decade.
Yeah, we co-edited when Jim was fairly new as editor.
That's right.
He asked us to put together a poetry anthology. So we came up with this idea that we would take poems from poets from the beginning of the decade and then poems from the end of the decade by the same poets and see what happened. And
people responded. Yeah, yeah, it was really pretty exciting, actually. Yeah.
That's great. Let's hear your poem.
This is called The Night Clock. A few things about the poem. The Pope referred to in this poem is Alexander VII. He was an insomniac since childhood. He was the former Cardinal Fabio Chigi, and the Campani brothers who are mentioned in the poem were brilliant clockmakers who he employed. They were known for inventing the wandering hour dial as well as the mercury-driven silent encasement for this particular clock. Prior to this time, a burning candle or oil lamp was set beside a clock at night if one was fortunate enough to have a clock. There are two dates that are important early on in the poem because they're current fairly. One is 9/11 and the other is 11/8. The date of the last U.S. presidential election, need I remind you. The night clock. Years after the Pope found he couldn't sleep, I do not posit it had to do with his prior position as Inquisitor of Malta. This Fabio Chigi, in 1655, asked the Campani brothers to make him one of those clocks you may have wanted after 9/11 or 11/8, something that wouldn't wake you in the night, with its illumination. Yet if you glanced its way, you would see the correct numeral as the wandering hour dial displayed 2 or 3 a.m. in a cutout by the glow of the oil lamp now inside the clock case. Only enough light to let you know that you remain alive, though in a time that men more powerful than you tell yourself, had set ticking with no silent crank encasement, no flue to channel the smoke, as farther and harder the brass tooth drops and the gear train advances forward.
The Night Clock by Trish Reeves, whose most recent poetry collection is called God Maybe. Before that was UMKC graduate John Mester, who's now a writer for an immigration law firm and on the board of the Writer's Place in Kansas City. Next up, H.C. Palmer, whose first poetry book, Feet of the Messenger, was published by our own Bookmark Press. For this magazine issue, he wrote a review of John Balaban's poetry book, Empires.
I have a letter from John Balaban, whose book I reviewed. Actually, Bob only took about 200 words out of it. It was pretty good. So we're going to take a couple more words.
Yeah, it was Balaban, after all.
Yeah. From John Balaban. Talked to him on the phone, and he was upset that Bob was leaving, of course, and he wrote this little bit. Over the years of sending poems to new letters, I came to admire Bob Stewart's editing as he fit together issues of marvelous work from a spectrum of well-known and lesser-known poets and writers. Every now and then, I'd send him a poem by one of my students. Sometimes he took one. His vision for new letters was rich and encompassing, not surprising if you know Stewart's own fine poetry in his recent collection, Working Class.
Thank you very much. So H.C. Palmer's poetry has also appeared in new letters, but you need to pick up a copy of this particular issue, volume 86, number 1 and 2, to read his review of John Balaban's work. It's Poetry and Peace in Action. And here comes Karen Miriam Goldberg. We're on to the gold part of the program now. I asked her just a little while ago if this is the first time she's been published in new letters. And the answer is?
Yes, it is. When I moved to the Kansas City area in 1981, I quickly found new letters and I thought, well, I'm a poet. That's my dream. I will one day get published in new letters. And so I sent a batch of poems, probably by 1985, and they were rejected. And about 4 or 5 years later, I sent another batch, and they were rejected. You know, who knew? 34 years later, sometime in the last year, I felt like something was missing from my life, and I realized, oh, I haven't been rejected from new letters lately. So better send something in. I had no idea it would be the last issue that you edited, Bob, and I'm honored to be included in this issue. And in fact, when I got the acceptance letter, I read it as a rejection letter, and a few minutes later I thought, wait a minute, it didn't have that phrase, your work does not fit the needs of our publication, so I went back in.
Karen Miriam Goldberg is one of our Kansas Poets Laureate. Anyway, your poem.
Thresholds. My friend stumbles from bed to table to bed, his sister-in-law again explaining to him why he can't go up the stairs anymore or down the summer street without clothes, which don't make sense to him since crossing the threshold of all this pain. A spray of lightning bugs ignites broken stitches across the dark, and I walk the gravel drive to my mother-in-law's house to tell her aide about her bouquet of mini strokes or something else no one diagnoses, because what would it matter now? When I step over the threshold into my friend's house, he puts his hand over his heart and bows. He knows he's dying, and in a week or a month, he'll just be an outline no one can fill between bed and table. like my mother-in-law lingering for what will be years until she breathes her early morning over. Outside all of this, inside too, the gears of blossom keep turning, all the doors continually open wide, and not just to death or disappearance. The world keeps telling us how much there is to step through.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you. That was Thresholds by Karen Miriam Goldberg, her first poem in New Letters magazine. Now, last but definitely not least, I know it's a cliche, Bob's editing me already. We have Albert Goldbarth, who drove up here from Wichita, has been published in the magazine a lot, but has multiple books. How long have you been in Wichita?
About 32, 33 years.
Wow, it's a long time.
Wow, yeah. Actually, my first year there was a long time.
Yeah. But you've gotten used to it now.
It made me the man I am today. Am I really the last?
You are the last.
Oh, then I want to repeat it. I think it's worth emphasizing there is not a better literary journal in the country than the New Letters that Bob created out of what he inherited. Page by page, issue by issue, year by year. It's an extraordinary read, and I own copies of Bob's poetry, and he's a wonderful poet himself and modest about it, I should say. But the modesty leads me to say what I think cannot be emphasized enough. Above that, below that, and all around that, Bob is just a decent human being. Every issue has a radiant political heart. If there were more people on this planet like Bob Stewart, we would not be in our current situation. And more people would publish me. I have a poem in here called Persist that's actually in three sections, and in order to make things a little slimmer for everybody, I'm going to read its first section and its last section, which I think work together well enough. It's a fitting poem for a kind of farewell. Although every time you exit one room, you enter another. Persist. The way that Whitney Houston could extend a final note, extend the word inside that final note like some ethereal taffy being pulled out of her lungs and up to the stars, or a wire extended into invisibility, and yet its tensile strength would slice your heart in two. That's how it is. We won't let go. Our overwhelming and formative passions ask that we hold on to them still and still more and still aftermath more. They ache for the dig of our fingernails. They want our tongue to fasten like a remora. A bouquet still floats above the long-gone shelf life date, and the contrail feathers still embellish the sky when the jet has disappeared. And Ishmael? When the operatically epic voyage ends, and the Pequod sinks, and all of its voices drown, a final note still lingers, clings like a barnacle to its rolling spar, a persistence that carries a novel inside. When R, a former high school music teacher, finally died, she was holding some sheet music tightly against her chest, and her fingers on the ruled staves made it look as if she were playing guitar. for her last act here on the earth. Air guitar, I guess. And then, in a while, she was air herself. In the grave of Queen Shub'ad at Ur, that eminence was found on her bier with the bodies of two women attendants positioned, one at the head and one at the foot, human sacrifices. Also there, a man's skeleton, the court harpist. His arm bones were still lying across his broken instrument, with its bull's head of gold and lapis lazuli, which he evidently had been holding fast even as he died. We can't know what his music meant to him, but we do know he wouldn't let go.
Albert Goldbarth, reading Persist.
Angela Elam asking me a question.
Well, I was going to make a statement more than a question, and this shows Bob's devotion to editing. Albert is one of these people who doesn't do email. The only way you can get in touch with him is to call him or write him a letter. And so all of the editing that you two do, how did you manage that? Was it over the phone you would tell him about things, or is he just so good you'd take it?
Editing?
Well, Albert's poems come in the mail on really high quality, gorgeous paper. They're all hand typed on a manual typewriter. And it's rare to find anything that you want to change or that you dare change, but they are flawless. I mean, every once in a while I'll see some little whiteout on something and I'll think, oh, I should photograph that. But I think I've made a couple of very small edits and asked if I could do that. It's incredibly rare. The manuscripts, they're pristine. They're like works of art.
Yeah. This has been better than my wedding night.
Albert, do you have anything else to say?
It's been a pleasure and an honor. I'm sure the magazine remains in good hands, but Bob's editorship was a sort of anomaly, a lucky, magical, once-in-a-lifetime experience for all of contemporary American literature.
Wow. Well, speaking of leaving the magazine in good hands, Bob has been working very closely with Christy Hodgen since when? October, I think? Or was it November? Somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Can you guys talk about what's ahead?
Well, we have one more issue that you're overseeing.
Right. We are putting together a selection of short stories from past issues of the magazine.
Which I think is really nice because Christy is a fiction writer. And so that's kind of a review of what fiction has been in the magazine, and it seemed poignant to me. Well, Bob's not dying. He will be here, you know. So.
Well, we're not going to let him go.
Yeah.
I would like to say one or two things. The first thing I want to say is that nobody wants to take over editing new letters from Bob Stewart. It's impossible to do as good a job as he's done. In fact, these last few months I've been thinking of him as Bob Stewart, because he's just been an extraordinary steward of the magazine and the entire University House. And it's daunting to try to take that baton from him. So then it became clear that one of us would have to do it. And, you know, we were all kind of terrified.
By one of you, you're talking about the creative writing department at UMKC.
Yeah. And I think our feeling was sort of like, you might as well ask us to fly a plane. Like, we don't, it's not going to happen. Nobody knows how to do this. And then it became clear that I was going to be that person. And I just thought, you know, I'm going to crash this plane. This is bad news for everybody. But I feel very fortunate that there's been enough overlap that I've been able to watch Bob So in that place of anxiety and terror, I was trying to make myself feel better and think of ways that it might be possible that I could take over from Bob. And I thought of two things that might qualify me. And one is that about a year after I started this job, I was looking around the conference room at a department meeting and sort of taking stock of everyone. And I realized that Bob was the only person who talked less than me. Which is saying something, because I never talk. And I thought, that's good. I think I like him. We'll never know, because neither one of us ever talks. But you know, maybe we could be friends. And then a couple years later, someone asked me to design a syllabus for a nonfiction course. And I said I would. And then that person, sometime later, handed me an old syllabus from Bob's magazine writing class. And I had already been putting together a list of readings that I would like to assign. I had about 6 or 7 books that I thought would be good for a nonfiction class. And this person handed me Bob's syllabus, and it was the same list.
You're kidding.
Same list. I thought, all right, we could be friends. We'll never know. I never dreamed that I could learn a job from him, from the master. I think the most important qualification that I've learned in the past few months is that you have to be willing to perform this incredibly selfless act of love. And that is the first job. That's what I've watched him do, and that's my plan.
Christy Hodgen is our first woman editor for New Letters. Mm-hmm. And so
speaking of Christy, the one thing that I understand about her that I'm so thrilled with is that she really has a passion for literary journals. And I can just tell it, I know from talking to her, and that's the most encouraging thing, aside from the fact that she's one of the greatest prose writers that I know of around here. So I'm very much encouraged. A lot of people tonight have spoken about New Letters as a great magazine, and thank you, all of you people who said that. I'm just tremendously touched by the comments. But I feel like I'm passing on to Christy a great staff of people at Bookmark Press, Cynthia Beard and Ben Furnish, and Jamie Walsh and Angela at the radio. And I want to point out one in particular, and that's Ashley Wan, who's assistant editor at New Letters. She runs our awards competitions. She's taken over a job that's been dumped on her recently, and she's absolutely indispensable at the magazine, and she has been just a great colleague, and I just could not have functioned without her. But I do want to mention a couple of colleagues and people who've passed away recently. Dan Jaffe, who founded Bookmark Press. Joan Yeagley, the poet, who was one of the first people on the board at Bookmark Press. And also, I have to mention this, there are a lot of people in this room who've been published in New Letters and not in this particular issue. And it's your great work that we honor here. So thank you all for coming. Let's get some wine and celebrate.
That's it. Editor Robert Stewart's final issue of New Works for New Letters magazine, with a photo of his chicken on the cover, can be found at newletters.org, along with links and earlier interviews with many of the poets you heard today. From UMKC, today's show has music from Kevin MacLeod's and Compotech.com and was produced with Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.